Okay, so we're recording on video. I've got the audio recording. So we're up and running. And so, yeah, I'll begin, Jim, by apologizing for not putting you to sleep last night. It's a bit unusual to be accused of not putting someone to sleep, but there you go. Or I guess blamed, I guess is a better word than accused. So, this is the beginning of the last week. Let me move this over here so I'm actually looking at you when I speak to you. There we go. So, as usual, I'm running behind in my videos. So they will continue probably for a bit after the last week, but Mark suggested that after the end of the last video that I produced, that we come back together for a wrap-up party, bring the champagne or the scotch, whatever you find most appropriate for this. I may be halfway through the recording of the videos for the decisions we make section. You saw the ones I guess I've restored. See, I did the one on how AI works, which is a simple introduction to AI, and we're gonna have to revisit that. Uploaded the one on the educational context. Now, the original version of that I uploaded was clipped at 14 minutes. Thank you, live streaming YouTube. But I always make a backup recording. So I had when I'm making one of those live stream YouTube videos. So happily, I had that recording. And so I've uploaded that, so we have the full version of the video now. And of course, we always had the audio and the transcript for that. And then over the weekend, I got data crazy. So that really is one big long presentation on data, but I've broken it into four parts, looking at the different aspects of data. So what I still have to do for this module, the part that I've been working on most recently, and I was going to say I should, but no, I will come out with one, is on algorithms and I forget exactly what I call it. Hang on. Tools and algorithms. Mostly it's about algorithms, learning theories, topologies, stuff like that. Oh, there's Mark. This is one of these things where I sort of need to be careful because there's, the field of AI is, so deep and so complex that it would be really easy to spend the rest of my life talking about it. And going deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And it would take the rest of my life because I have to learn about it first and then talk about it. I've got a good overall grasp of it, but if I'm going to talk about it on a video, I need to make sure that I've got it solid in my head. So that is slowing me down a bit, but such is life. Anyhow, I want to talk about that. And then after that, there's a couple. I'd say two major other aspects of the overall workflow that we're talking about. And that's the model itself and how we interpret the model, which would be the next video after the one coming up. And then testing and application. And I'll talk a little bit about AI explicability in there as well. Or explainability. I'm not sure what word you want to use. Then I'll have a wrap-up for that module, titled something like The Machine is Using Us. Yeah. Obviously, I'm borrowing from the Michael Wesch video there. But, just to bring it full circle, because One of the things that's different, I think, in the way I approach AI and AI is that I think of our overall society, culture, social network, etc., as a big giant AI. Although it's not, I mean, it's not artificial, it's human and real. So it doesn't follow any of these set algorithms, but we can detect patterns that we see in the algorithms in society as a whole. And I find that an interesting way of thinking about how we as a culture or as a species think as a whole. You know, I mean, we can also talk about how we think as individual people, and I do that with neural nets. Lots of people do that with neural nets. But there's less talk about how cultures think. And I shouldn't say that. There's lots of talk about how cultures think, but it's almost all theory-based. Actor network theory or this theory, that theory. I don't even know them all. I'm not interested in them because, you know, it's sort of like cognitive psychology for society. And, you know, I don't even like cognitive psychology for people, much less cognitive psychology for society. So I want to look at, I want to think about, you know, if we think of society as a network and don't try to force theories on it, what does that tell us about how we learn and what we learn? And that's particularly appropriate for the current investigation because when we're trying to think about ethics, we've gone through all of those different ethical theories and all those different approaches to ethics and all the considerations and the values and then the sorts of things that come up and the ethical issues and the ethical codes, and, including all the way up to all the stuff on data that I did over the weekend. And, you know, we can't describe that using theory. You know, it's sort of like cognitive psychology for ethics, right? We keep trying, but I don't think we can. We may be able to make observations about some of the outcomes of it, but I think that the way society talks about ethics and the way we learn about ethics is in this network kind of process that we would talk about in AI, where you can't get at, well, the way I've been saying it in the videos, right? Instead of talking about 14 variables, the way we like to do with theories, we're talking about 60,000 variables, the way we would talk about in the neural net. You know, and in any given ethical decision, any given ethical context, we are, as individuals and as society, taking into account 60,000 variables. Now, that's a number I've picked out of the air. It's not quite out of the air. It's based on that one example of the AI that I offered at the beginning of the Module 7. If that's actually how ethics is created and applied, and I think it is, then what does that tell us about how we can have ethical AI? So we need to turn the snake back in on its own tail here. This is basically the sense that I'm going to try to get at in Module 8, after all this discussion about different decisions we make in AI, which will basically, I think, go to show that, yeah, we need to take into account 60,000 parameters, is that how do I want to phrase this? It's hard. And I'm still not sure exactly how I want to phrase this. But maybe something like this. ethics is like culture, in the sense that it's got all of these inputs, all of these different variations.
It's still badly put.
It's something that we do all together, each of us, by doing things, interacting with each other, making decisions on the spot, etc. It's like a language, even. Like a language, like a culture, anything that, you know, even like a city, or like a country or community, any of these really complex things that we build up together through a series of actions and artifacts. And so the question of how to make AI ethical, well, the question of what is ethical is the sum total of all of that. And then the question is, how do we apply all of that to ethics? And it's hard because, you know, we're, the other unknown that we've addressed in this course is, what exactly would be ethical AI? I mean, what is ethical? We don't even have a statement, you know, as to what is ethical AI. And there isn't going to be one, and it's going to be each particular application of AI. So our circle is something like, we have AI practitioners who have learned ethics, and they've learned ethics from society. Society has, in its various ways of doing this, taught them ethics. Society has learned ethics as this large network process of interactions, and basically, I don't want to say invented ethics, but basically invented ethics. And the way it's done that is through these individual actions that people consider to be right or wrong. And it is a circular thing. But I think it's always been a circular thing. And, you know, we could come up various explanations as to why it worked out that way. Some people argue for example, evolutionary arguments. I think that there are a lot of practical explanations for a lot of ethical principles that, you know, we sort of suggest as broad hypotheses that are probably wrong in specific applications, but, you know, might form overall explanations. Take, for example, a religious prohibition against eating shellfish. We could explain that as divine revelation, but that probably wouldn't help us much. A better explanation might be that in the context when this religion was being developed, it was really dangerous to eat shellfish. They were often rotted, spoiled, or they would pick up toxins from the water, etc. And so, especially, you know, in environments which are hot, so shellfish wouldn't last very long after you take them out of the water. They definitely have to be cooked. So pretty good reasons all in all for not eating shellfish. Similarly with a prohibition against pork. And here I refer to, believe it or not, an episode of Tapestry on CBC. Just as an aside, I really don't like that show very much, but CBC is always on. And they were talking about the Muslim prohibition against pork, and again, the explanation came out that at that time and at that place, it was dangerous to eat pork. But those are explanations as to how these things may have arrived and become part of our overall ethic, and not what makes them right or wrong, right? Because then that would be a very, very utilitarian, consequentialist view of ethics. And again, you know, that's one way of explaining it, maybe, but certainly not a prescriptive principle. But what makes something right or wrong is this overall social determination that an act is right or wrong in a given context that we try to extract generalizations from but usually fail. And that leads us to the problem of AI, to my mind, the central problem of AI. This is all off the top of my head summary of Module 8. So, and the problem of AI is AI is only going to be as ethical as society is. You know, however ethical society is as a whole, that's how ethical AI will be. Because society trains the AI authors. The AI authors reflect their ethics in the AI. That's what we get out of it. And indeed, we can draw the same line using data, right? Society constitutes the data that we use to train AI. The AI brings in that data, and that's what we get. The AI learns from the data and becomes as ethical as the input data. And, you know, we've seen those examples like Tay, where the input data was racist and therefore the AI was racist. But think of this on a broad scale. And it makes it hard simply to make an ethical judgment about the outcome of an AI, because if we're just using a simple ethical principle, then we can make judgments about the AI. But if we're looking at society as a whole, how can you say the AI is behaving unethically when the behavior of the AI is what society thinks is ethical behavior, not by what they say, but by what they actually do? And so if I had to summarize in slogan form, if we want AI to be more ethical, then we as a society have to be more ethical. No other way around that. I thought you froze out. Jim Suffer's frozen out. He's just coming back in now. There we go. Jim Suffer, he, him again. So I'm not sure you should be able to hear it. So I'll just say...
Yeah. I'm echoing my frills on my computer was unresponsive, so I've come back on my phone. I'm going to, because I didn't want to miss what you were saying, but carry on, and I'll come back on my computer in a bit.
All right. So to wrap it up, I'm sorry, but they basically, the thing that I just said was, in order to get more ethical AI, we have to become a more ethical society. And it's, that's a hard kind of statement, right? And it's kind of a weird ethic. It reminds me of, was it Pascal's? Philosophy that we live in the best of all possible worlds. I might say something like, we live in the most ethical of all possible worlds. That's not strictly true, but it is true in the sense that whatever is ethical is what we decide is ethical. We can sometimes say as individuals, this action was wrong, that action was wrong. But ethics is, a property of society as a whole. So whatever ethics is whatever society as a whole does. We are as ethical as we are as a society, and that's what ethics is. Welcome, Doug Smith. And this is your first visit, just as we're in the last module on the course, but nonetheless, perhaps you've been following along. It's certainly nice to see you here. And you're on mute.
Thank you, I've been lurking.
Well, welcome to the D-Lurker. So, okay, I'll stop with my opening remarks there. Again, just a quick summary for Jim and for Doug, and we assume Mark is there listening. The idea here is that ethics is not composed of a set of principles or rules or anything like that. It's a complex response by society or by individuals that takes into account not 14, 20, whatever, principles or states of affairs, or variables, I should say, but 60,000, pick a number out of the air, variables. It's incredibly complex, and we address it in this complex fashion, both as individuals and as society. As individuals, we learn what constitutes ethical from society as a whole, from all of our interactions with all of the other people in society, and also states of affairs in the world. And we apply that learning to what we believe is ethical behavior in our own lives. And society learns what is ethical from the individual applications of what we believe is ethical behavior in our own lives, taken as a totality. So it's this great big circle that we could explain the origins of some of these things with various theories, but the explanation of an origin of an ethical theory isn't what makes the particular application of it right or wrong. What makes it right or wrong is the fact that society believes that this is ethical as a whole, or the fact that you as an individual believe that something is ethical as a whole, which means that in an important way, we are as ethical as we can be, society is as ethical as it can be, and if we want our AI to be ethical, our AI will be as ethical as we and society are. If we want AI to be more ethical, we have to be more ethical individually and as a society, whatever that amounts to. And that's the hard part. It's like, how do you determine what a more ethical society would look like when ethics simply is this application of what we think is ethical? Again, we're back in the circle again, so I won't do the circle all over again. Thoughts and comments?
I think you're exactly right, Stephen. And what part of the fear is that the AI will get ahead of us. By the time we establish a reasonable foundation of ethics for ourselves and society, AI will be at the point where it's now deciding and it's too late for us to influence the AI.
Sharita, what do you think?
I don't have a hard and fast thing. I guess what I'm responding to is you really are describing AI as more evolutionary. It's not a fixed point. It will change over time or change with whatever society that you're in. And it's something that always needs some kind of discussion. So who has that discussion? Right? As a whole society, it's hard to have a discussion. Mm-hmm. The five of us here could have a discussion, but how much does that really affect the ethics of AI in Microsoft? Not a lot.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting from it. So it could change. I mean, if Donald Trump were still in power, one argues whether he is still in power, since the media spends so much time paying attention to him, would our ethics change. And I think our ethics in many ways are changing.
Yeah. Jim, thoughts?
Yeah, I'm kind of with Sherita, a bit pessimistic about my ability to affect society as a whole. So I'm, you know, I don't think I can influence the Amazons or the Googles or the Microsofts to adopt my ethics.
Right.
I can't promote them in my small circle. That's the wrong way, my ethics. I can promote this idea that you introduced a while back. We need to even think about the questions we can ask about ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can introduce that in my small circle, in my center, you know, part of the Center for Teaching and Learning in a small community college. It covers the whole Northwest Territories in Canada, but, yeah. You know, I have a little bit of influence there, no power, but a little bit of influence. And that's where we can have discussions about ethics. I mean, one of the things we're looking at right now is how does our college, oppression, not a popular term, but how are we exercising oppression over our majority Indigenous students? So that's an ethical question that we're applying to education.
I lost you at one of the things we're applying right now.
Oh, is... how are we perpetuating the oppression of our majority student population being Indigenous?
Ah, right.
Oppression is not a popular word to use, but that's kind of where our ethics hits the road.
Right. And I think it's a fine word. I mean, if they still don't have clean water to drink, what else do you call it? Right. I mean...
Houses to live in,
etc. I mean, conditions that would be considered unacceptable anywhere else. I mean, even like when the water supply went out in Iqaluit, they moved heaven and earth to make sure that the water was restored in Iqaluit. Why there and not in some of the other First Nations communities across the country. Mark, I assume you've been listening all along. Any comments?
Yeah, I was just banging about too much, so I turned myself off. I don't even know where to start. I really don't know where to start. So as the, I guess, the only... United States in. Just to follow on, I'm in California. We have between 100,000 and 250,000 people living under bridges and overpasses.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just Native people. My real concern, so as the resident sociologist, I guess, in this group, I'm a little worried about this hand-waving at society, because there really isn't any such thing. It's a nice concept, but things get done in groups. Nothing gets done by a society. And that's my main concern with AI. It started right from the beginning. The ethics were all bourgeois, professional, society ethics, which is, you know, fine, but very narrow from the very beginning. And then the who's going to design the AI is such a much smaller subset. And then we looked at the problems with data. And data collection and data processing. So I'm just not feeling very hopeful either. And I did find this wonderful issue from the Royal Society that I just found. So I'll be looking at it. Bounded rationality, abstraction, and hierarchical decision making, and information theoretic optimality yeah, principle. Because I found that because I started off thinking, okay, so what are we doing? You know, AI is interesting. It does affect all of us, but I don't consciously use it. I don't own any AI that I'm aware of. I use Google products, but I don't really own them. And so I brought it down to we're making decisions. We're talking about making decisions. And we're talking about designing machines to make decisions. And we've, I think, pretty much established that that cannot be transparent. You like 60,000. There's another quibble. Am I making decisions when I take a walk based on my 12 ethical principles? Or do I have such an overwhelming amount of input that it can't be quantified, and yet I'm still able to make decisions? So, you know, there's two ways to look at that. So AI is either an expansion of the data used in decision making or a contraction. It can be looked at from both ways. But my main concern is the transparency. So in a democratic society, when you, I was going to say unleash, that's not really coming. When you apply artificial intelligence, and again, it only applies in certain areas, and who makes those decisions? But when you apply artificial intelligence, I'm afraid you might be constricting your options, even though it appears you're expanding.
Awesome. Okay. Let's make this concrete. Because you're right, it is a bit hand-wavy, especially when I talk about society as a whole. Although, I want to be kind of precise when I talk about society as a whole. So let's do that first, and then we'll take it to a concrete example. There is what we might call a global social network. With the exception of a few hermits, and even they were born and thus interacted with someone at some point, but with the exception of a few hermits, everybody is connected to everybody in some way. There's no division in society so great that they're completely cut off from other people. Well, except for the tribe that lives in the Andaman Islands, which is genuinely cut off from all the rest of society, and possibly some groups of people in the Amazon rainforest, and I think possibly some in New Guinea. But other than that, right, there is this mass of connected people. And we know that because a disease that starts in Wuhan, China, or anywhere, spreads to all corners of the earth. And it's transmitted from person to person to person. So we know, right? There's nobody that's immune. You know, we're seeing it, you know, in the high Arctic in Canada. We're seeing, I've been following some people in Antarctica, and they've managed to keep themselves isolated from it. The South Pole Station, zero cases of COVID. So good for them.
Well, there goes the vapor trail theory. Darn.
Well, no, I mean, you can block it, right? If you do not have, you know, if you have not already been infected and you make sure that you are not in contact with infected people, you will not become infected. But anyhow, it's not a talk about COVID. It is a talk about the connectivity of society. And to a large degree, almost to 100%, not quite, but almost to 100%, everybody's connected to everybody. And also, the artifacts that we create, the objects we create, cities, towns, bridges, buildings, etc., those also create connections between us. Those are what we might call stigmergic connections. We're connected by means of objects that we leave behind. So, that entire network isn't ever doing one thing at a time. And that's your point, Mark, right? Society as a whole doesn't do any one thing at a time. It's really, it's 7 billion people. It's like when you look at a brain, a human brain. Not everything in your human brain is doing one thing at a time. But yet you can still say things like, and these are broad generalities, like humanity went to the moon, right? Because there was a state prior to which any person was on the moon. Now there's a state where there is a person on the moon, or was a person on the moon, right? But we can say that. We can make other broad statements. But really what we're doing when we say things like that is we're taking a perspective or point of view of this great big network, right? We don't even see the whole network. We miss most of it. And we look at it as an individual. We look at the part of the network that we can see, and we maybe recognize patterns in that, and we say, okay, society did such and such. So, Mark, you're probably looking more at the parts you can see from your perspective in California. Jim is looking at the perspective he can see from Northern Canada. Doug, I don't know where you are. Where are you located?
Pennsylvania, United States.
Pennsylvania.
Okay. Oh, USA and whatever we're not America.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
So you're looking at the perspective you can see from Pennsylvania, etc. As an aside, this is a bracketed aside. That's sort of the design of a convolutional neural network, right? Where you have this big matrix of all of these possibilities, and you have a system that samples a little bit, and then samples a little bit, and samples a little bit. So each one of us is one of these things that samples a little bit. And then we interact together, and we forward whatever our considerations are. So there is a sense to be made of saying that society as a whole works together. There is a sense to be made that subsets of society do things. Groups or organizations or whatever that features that we're able to detect in society of ways people have organized themselves. So that's in general what's happened. So let's take it to the specific now. Our favorite example. Robot dogs with machine guns. I know, Mark, you don't like to call them robot dogs. And that's part of it.
Quadrupeds.
Right, quadrupeds with machine guns, right?
Armored quadrupeds.
Armored autonomous quadrupeds with machine
guns. Exactly. Thank you.
Yes. Now, there are two things we can say about that. Well, three things. I'll say the obvious thing first. They exist. We've seen pictures, right? So, one thing we can say is that at least some people in this great big society of ours think that they're good, right? Because they exist. If they didn't think they were good, they wouldn't have made them. Well, okay, that's a bad generalization, but remember, we can't generalize at all here like this, right? So,
useful or valuable, maybe not good, but useful or valuable.
Useful, valuable, but that might be what counts as good to them, right? There's no one definition of good. But, let's think like a neural network, a bad one. Let's go and ask every single person that exists, do you think this is good? Do you think armed, whatever we call them, robot dogs, right? Autonomous quadrupeds with weapons, do you think they're good, right? If we asked each person in society, there would be a subset that said yes, right? And there would be a subset that said no, and there would be a subset that went, huh? Right? So we're asking the global question, are autonomous, machine gun equipped, etc. We need a name for them. Autonomous quadrupeds with
armed autonomous quadrupeds.
Armed autonomous quadrupeds. OX. AAQ.
We'll call that rolls off the tongue, kind of.
Hey? Yeah, it rolls off the tongue. It's at least as rolly off the tongue as moop. So OX. You have to say it with a little accent, right? OX. Because you know you.
After a Scottish accent would be appropriate, I think.
So, so overall, let's ask, does society accept or believe, or whatever you want to say, that ox are good? And you might say, well, you can't say that about a society. But if you can say that about a human, you can say that about a society. That's the inferential leap I make here, right? Because the same kind of determination is being made by society as a whole. If we think of it as one great big whacking network, right? Not as sophisticated as our human brains. It's less sophisticated. But that's only because we don't have enough people yet. And our communication systems are broken in so many ways. But... you know, if a human can say an ox is good or an ox is bad, society, we could say that. Society says an ox is good or an ox is bad. So how do we determine that? Well, let's look at society and ask whether society has tolerated the existence of ox. It has. So society as a whole must think ox are good. Now, there's a part of society that entertains the possibility that ox are bad. There's a part of society that doesn't care. But overall...
I would say the vast majority of society is unaware of ox.
Yeah, that's true. It's just like the vast majority of your neurons are unaware of what you're hearing right now. Right? They'll play a role in this, whether they want to or not... All right, because everything is connected with everything. And the role that they're playing right now is they don't care. It's just not important enough to them to make a difference. All right, as compared to, say, putting on a mask, right, where the vast majority of society has an opinion one way or another. Because either they put on a mask, which indicates they're fine with it, or they resist putting on a mask, which indicates that they're not fine with it. And society as a whole, for the most part, is saying that putting on a mask is good. And if we had to, you know, if we were forced into saying, does society think masks are good? Does society think masks are bad? If we had to make a call, we'd probably go fall on the side of society thinks masks are good. Now, of course, it's not that simple because it's never that simple. But that's what our ethics is made of. And we could sit here, we could probably sit here for the rest of the day and ask questions. Are nuclear weapons good? Well, they're all over the place, and we haven't stopped them yet. So, yeah, society thinks nuclear weapons are good. Electoral district gerrymandering good? Yeah, overall, society thinks, again, society's fine with it, so it must be good. Now, if you ask me, that's pretty crappy morality that I've been describing so far, but that's just me. Right? But the way we're set up, it's a big whacking network, and it doesn't do what I say. But that's a good thing. right? I mean, people bemoan the fact that, you know, and we just heard somebody saying, you know, what I say or what I believe really probably won't influence what Microsoft does. Well, that's a good thing. Nothing personal. Right? Because, you know, first of all, how would you pick such a person? Second, how would you know what they're saying actually is ethical? Right? So we don't want it to be the case, I think, that one person...
just described reality.
Yeah.
Bill Gates decides what Microsoft does. Because he has the wealth and the power to do that.
Now we're in a more interesting discussion, right?
Yeah.
So now we're in
discussing what the world thinks about COVID and masks.
Yeah.
As an aside, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, as an aside, but now we're in the much more interesting question, right? Because let's leave aside the question of robot dogs. Sorry.
Ox. You mean the ones patrolling his fence up in Washington?
Yeah.
Who really knows is that?
And let's consider the question of how does society as a whole get to the point where it thinks robot dogs are good or bad? In other words, to me, the question is, how do we organize that network?
So I think it's a matter of how people get to that point is a matter of the perceptions of power. If you accept you have power ox, then you might be in favor of using them to expand your power.
Yeah.
And I think that can be applied to a lot of other decisions we make. It's based on our perception of our power and whether it has the potential to harm anybody we care about.
Yeah. Well, not just the potential. I mean, in a different sense. Like, if I had an ox, that wouldn't be bad because I know I wouldn't use it to harm people. Right? That's the reason. Well, yeah, but it responds to me. It's, you know, it's autonomous, but, you know, you don't just send them out into the world without any objectives or anything, right? So, you know, I wouldn't give it any harmful purposes, right? Similarly,
any mammals taller than a Saint Bernard. I would not want to be a toddler in your world.
So, my Siberian tiger, kind of a problem?
Let me interject something.
Yeah?
Because as you're talking, I'm thinking of a concrete example,
mm-hmm,
of how ethics and... a group in society might change something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to use ethical investment.
Sure.
Which is, you know, ethical or social investment, etc. Which, let's say, around the year, I don't know, 2000, 2003, was much more of an uphill battle,
mm-hmm,
than it is today.
I agree.
And part of the reason has been the discussions or the learning or the education of stakeholders in terms of some companies being traded, right? You know, in the stock market. And what's had to happen is those stockholders in that company had to really make up their minds through discussion, learning, etc., that they did not want that particular company to make clothes in wherever, where it's the, you know, with almost slavery.
Right.
And they won out. And more and more of this is happening. So you're getting a gradual shift in a certain context of ethics. And it had to do also with money. And money is power. And what these stakeholders did was they used their power, their money, to change something. So I think power is really important.
I think power is important. In my notes for Module 8, I have a section on agency, and I think that's important. And I'm not sure if I have it in there or not, but there's the section on how we organize or structure society to limit the influence of individuals. And then I don't mean limit the influence of 99% of individuals, but to limit the influence of, say, a Bill Gates or an Elon Musk or whatever. Because, I mean, the way I explain it is in networks like a human neural network, there are physical limits. A neuron can only have so many connections, right? A single neuron only has so much influence in our brain. There is no neuron in charge, right? We couldn't even identify, the top 100 neurons. That wouldn't make sense. But we could do that with humans, and that's a problem. So things like financial markets, financial networks, are what they call scale-free. There are no natural limits to the extent of, well, in the case of financial markets, the amount of money a single person can have. There's no upper limit. Especially if they get into a position where they can just make money, they just keep making it until whenever. There's no, and more to the point, there's no real limit or practical limit on the difference between the wealthiest and the least wealthy. The wealthiest person has billions of times more wealth than the least wealthy. And that's the sort of difference that we don't see in natural networks. Now, this is not an appeal to naturalism. I want to be careful about that. And we've learned that we can't just appeal to naturalism. And what I've taken as a core principle, and, again, principles are always wrong, but as a core principle is a principle of network design, essentially, which says that the design of a network that keeps it dynamic, reactive, changing, growing, in other words, responsive, is good. And designs of networks which cause them to move to a single state, those are generally bad. Because such a network is never responsive. Once you reach that state, it's done. That's the end of history, right? So an example of that is death. When we die, our brain is no longer sending signals, updating neural connections, etc. And arguably, that's also the point at which consciousness ends. Arguably. Some people disagree. We could depict in the case of networks some kinds of network topographies where this happens. For example, if every neuron is connected to every neuron, then we will end up in that state, this static state, because every neuron will be in the same state as every other neuron. Similarly, if no neuron is connected to any neuron, nothing would cause any neuron to change. And so again, we're in this state where there is no change. So somewhere in the middle of this connectivity is that middle point where there's enough connectivity, but not too much connectivity that allows for this dynamism to happen. That's just one example of such a property. Another example is, suppose every neuron is connected to one neuron. We'll call that the God model, right? The one neuron is God. And it says something, everybody listens and adopts that state. Well, again, we've reached this static state again. So it's not an ethical principle, right? But it's a suggestion about a design of a network that might be more responsive to changes in society, so more able to make decisions as a network than one that is less responsive, that would respond to more particular states. But, you know, that's very loose. Like I say, it can't be thought of as a general principle in any sense. Almost certainly, and certainly in individuals, a topography develops where there are clusters and organizations that we can identify, different parts of the brain, left and right hemisphere, all of that, as what Jerry Fodor would call the modularity of mind, although he was using that in a different sense. And in society as well, right? We have denser clusters and less dense clusters. What Joe Clark in Canada used to call a community of communities. And we get that as well. And all of this is constantly changing, constantly dynamic. And whatever, you know, and to the extent that we can make it a better world is the extent to which we can make it a better functioning network. Whatever that happens to be. And that's the hard question of morality, right? Are you willing to countenance the global social morality, if we wanted to call it that, that is different from your own? And that's the hard question to me.
And so I have a question before we run out of time, if we haven't already.
We're pretty much there. I've been babbling, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. So the question I brought today, based on the videos, the one question, is how will AI or this broader ethics handle deviance?
Handle
what? Because it seemed from your deviance.
Right.
Because it seemed from the description, you know, the ones and zeros, mm-hmm. less than one, more than one, whatever. I took basic math. So it seems to me that the AI, and again, designed by a very small subset of people, would tend to zero out deviance. And I like to talk about scale of deviance. What do I want to say? There's a range of deviance that's from negative to positive. We pretty much put murderers at the negative end of deviance. But we very seldom talk about positive deviance, which I would posit lead the culture in new directions, but are considered deviant at the time, like Galileo.
Yeah.
So my question is, wouldn't AI tend to zero out all deviants? whether positive or negative?
Short answer to that is no. The long answer to that is that AI doesn't simply work by averaging. You know, in some of the algorithms that I've been talking about, even in the intro part to AI, it works by extracting features. And some features might be more common, some features might be less common. And the less common ones are what we might mark as deviant. And that's an important
realization. It's a design problem?
Sorry?
It's a design problem? It's the group that designed the AI decide what deviants to look for?
Well, in a sense.
For amplifying?
You know, when you're doing feature detection, what really matters is what features you're looking for. Now, in some of these networks, they basically eliminated all the semantics of it and represent this purely mathematically by means of what might be called filters, right? So you take the state of affairs in the input, you apply a filter to it, which is really just a series of ones and zeros that you match against your series of ones and zeros, and then that gives you a filtered result, right? And each filter basically can be thought of as a way of identifying a particular feature. So you might have like an edge detector, you might have a line detector, you might have a circle detector, and these are just different filters that you apply to the input. So when we talk about deviance, by analogy, but it's not a bad analogy here, basically what we're doing is we're looking at the whole of society using some filters. If I wanted to play fast and loose with the metaphors, I might even say that there's something like George Lakoff's frames, but I won't play fast and loose with the metaphors. Just think of it just purely mechanically. We're looking at the world through a series of filters, right? And one of the filters is, say, people who kill people versus people who don't kill people, right? Another of the filters is men who prefer men versus men who don't prefer men. Another of the filters is people who wear blue versus people who wear red, right? We could come up with any number of these filters. In all cases, almost all cases, there are some exceptions. There will be a majority and minority for any of these features. And we could have like a number, I've just given you some binary filters here, but I can have, a 10-valued filter, no problem. So I get, 16 possibilities. Think of that Myers-Briggs test, right? The INTP as a 16-way filter, right? So we look at our filter. There's going to be some people that are only a very small percentage of the population, and other people which will represent larger percentages of the population. By definition, the people who are parts of the small percentage are deviant, by definition, right? But the question is, do we think that deviance is bad? Do we think that deviance is good? Or do we care? Right? Shirt color, we probably don't care, although in certain areas in Los Angeles, it matters a lot. Killing people, well, it turns out that's more contextual, but for the most part, we find it bad. There are contexts in which we find it good, and that, again, that depends. Now, each person has these filters. Each person takes the result of that filter and applying the rest of their own neural net, the rest of their previous knowledge, everything they've learned, etc., makes a determination whether that deviance is bad or good, or some point in between. It doesn't have to be binary. And then each of us feeds that into whatever networks we're connected to. So if you feel murdering is wrong, say, you know, in other words, if you feel that that deviant percentage of people who kill people without the proper paperwork, if that's bad, you will pass on your belief through your beliefs, through your statements, through your actions, through your own behaviors. I argued elsewhere that the modeling of the behavior is generally probably the most effective rather than just saying, but that's an aside. But you'll pass that on through the network. And but it's a small network effect, but if enough people or, you know, or if well-placed people in the network, depending on how the network is organized, if they also pass that along or propagate that belief or idea, then that becomes a property of, you know, a cultural pattern that we can recognize. We look at a society and we say, you know, as a whole, it appears that that subset of the whole social network, that society, feels that killing people without the right paperwork is wrong. It may also say coming up with really unorthodox ideas about the placement of the earth is good. And that, again, can change through time, right, depending on how each individual makes their own decision. So, you know, and what I'm trying to get at here is the complexity of the processing is at least as complex as the complexity of the data, right? It's never going to be a simple averaging or anything like that. In fact, that's one of the real distinctions that I make between group-based decision-making and network-based decision-making. Is group-based decision-making is based on weights in the sense of how many people think such and such. Democracy is a group-based decision-making system, right? You win the election if most people vote for you. But network-based decision-making doesn't depend on it. It allows that a lot of people simply won't care. And then it takes the organization of the people who are interested and involved in the matter in some way and runs that through a series of processes, a series of AI processes, different algorithms and such, and then results in an overall pattern of behavior that we then, as third parties looking at that pattern, say, okay, that is the network behaving in such and such a way. Does that make sense? And I should never ask, does that make sense?
Yeah, my interpretation of it is I just got terrified.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth being terrified about this. Because particularly when you throw artificial intelligences into the mix, because they won't, and this is what you were saying earlier, they won't just reflect what we all believe, right? That's what's going to kick it off. But then they'll start feeding back into the process. You know, just like anything else that we've built, everything we build feeds back into the process. You know, people built nuclear bombs that fed into a lot of opinions about war, etc. So,
yeah, I think that is a good analogy for, if not AI, for ops. So here we are. It seems the process is similar. You have a secret group designing a technology,
mm-hmm.
and then demonstrating.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain section of society, but it's very small, I would argue, that thinks, wow, that's great.
Yep.
And I would imagine, I guess is the only word I can use, that if you could poll, and I think the subset of people not connected to, I like Teilhard de Chardin's term, noosphere,
mm-hmm.
which is the conscious biomorphic field, right. separated from the rest of the biological Gaia,
yeah.
Another term that came later. I would argue that there's a much larger subset that's not connected to this technological noosphere. Than just some remote islands and the substations at the poles, who will never be considered. But I think if you, first of all, you have to explain all this to them, which would be very good.
Yep.
For them to become informed. And then if you polled them, I would imagine the vast majority of humanity would say that ox are a bad idea. And yet, as I said, I imagine they're patrolling some fences in the state of Washington and in some of the Arab Emirates today. This is my imagination. Mm-hmm. And I know that those kind of technologies filter down in society. Well, luckily nuclear weapons have, but all the other technologies filter down into societies, and in the United States, those military technologies get to our local police departments. So I'm already imagining demonstrations being broken up by ops. And this is terrifying. You know, this application of AI. And then when you point out how undemocratic AI is in itself, it seems to me, I mean, we're having enough problem with our democracy, such as it is, that I just don't see how, and I'll reach back to that word I didn't want to use, how AI is being unleashed on a world that can't understand it, and it will only be from the top down, and so it will be imposed.
So, and we need to end this reasonably soon, like within a few minutes, but I want to key in on one thing you said. And what you said was, the majority of people, if they knew about this, would believe such and such. And that's a hard thing to be able to say. First of all, it's a counterfactual, right? In fact, the majority of people don't know about this thing, right? So we're left with the problem of determining how most people would react if indeed they did know.
Yeah, that's impossible. I agree. And it's just impossible.
It's not simply impossible. It's problematic because there have been studies that suggest that just telling people, just giving people the knowledge isn't enough to change their behavior. Lots of people knew, for example, that smoking cigarettes would kill them, and they did not want to die, but they kept smoking cigarettes. Similarly, you know, there are certain factions, political factions, that believe things, like Robert F. Kennedy will come back from the dead, or not Robert F. Kennedy, John Kennedy will come back from the dead. I'd rather see Robert F., but I digress.
I think it's Scott Jr. that they believe is coming back.
Either way, right? In fact, he has not come back from the dead, and yet they continue to believe this. Right?
Yeah, the second coming of Christ has been predicted for 2,000 years and still hasn't happened.
Yeah. Well, and people actually come up with dates and then are caught. Anyhow, you get the idea, right? So that's one part. The other part is the bit where you said it doesn't matter what they think. And that's a weighting problem. And that speaks to individual agency. When I say that's a weighting problem, what I mean is that the strength of the connection between that person and the rest of society is too weak. Right? Their views, even if they're communicated, are simply not felt. And I think that's, I mean, in a sense, that's a structural problem, but in a sense, it's a learning problem in the sense that our society hasn't yet learned how to learn from itself. And that's why we use crude methods like votes, which is really, you know, I mean, a vote is kind of like artificially weighting. We just set everybody's weight to one on a very narrow question. Voting with your dollars, which was also mentioned, is another weighting solution, right? We'll set everybody's weight to the amount of dollars that they have and give them votes proportional to that. Not the best weighting solution in my mind, right? So what we know is that networks that are able to better manage weighting are able to make more informed decisions. No, let me say it a bit more neutrally, more nuanced decisions, or more decisions about more things. The democratic weighting system that we have really only works for, you know, a few decisions a year. But each of us every day needs to be making tens of thousands of decisions. So, but all of that taken in, right, we might still decide, and this is the possibility that we have to count in this, even with the best decision-making mechanism in the world, we might still decide that ox are good. Now, at a certain point, the question becomes, on what basis can you argue that ox are bad if the best possible decision-making process we've been able to build in society says that ox are good? Right. You're still perfectly free to believe and encouraged to believe, if you believe this, that ox are bad. Totally your right to do that. But the sum total of the overall weight of people who believe the same as you do in society as a whole loses on this issue.
Yeah, that's the deviance problem.
Yeah.
So it occurs to me that we probably need two things to happen. The first one is to expand the structure of communications, mm-hmm. so that more people can participate. But of course, that brings with it surveillance. So, you know, there's that problem. And then the second thing is, it seems to me, and now I'm being facetious, I don't want anybody misunderstanding here, being facetious.
Yep.
But it seems to me that the best thing that could happen is for those ox to be purchased by a nonprofit, programmed to not attack anything over a certain height so that no dogs are harmed in this experiment, and set loose on every continent so that some toddlers die. And then people will have an opinion about whether this is a good technology.
That's a feedback loop. That's a direct practical application of back propagation into the network. We try
to. Because before that, it's all theoretical.
Yeah.
And most people won't even hear the handling. But when those ox are unpacked in their locale and turned on, charged up and turned on, I'm still sticking with my opinion. I think most of them are not going to enjoy it.
Well, there's, and we'll wrap it up on this note, but there is a famous quote, and I forget who said it, but it came after the Sandy Hook massacre. And it was something like this, and I'm paraphrasing it. When the majority of Americans decided, I don't think they used the word majority. When Americans decided it was okay for children to be massacred at a school, that was the end of the argument. Right? It might be the case that even if ox go out and kill some kids, people might be fine with them. And at that point, the argument that you can make that they're morally bad begins to founder. Now, you can still believe they're morally bad, but society as a whole, as it stands now, remember, it's a constantly changing, dynamic, evolving thing. Maybe evolving is the wrong word. A constantly dynamic and changing thing. Right? So it might change its mind. Right? But if it does, it will almost certainly not be based on single instances of ox killing kids. It would be an overall global change, like what they call a sea change in society. And it would be related to tons and tons of other thoughts and beliefs, ranging from how important we think kids are, how we value the life of an individual in society, how much we love our machines, whether we feel afraid, 60,000 factors. And that's...
Yeah, I think power is the one that's going to dominate the discussion.
Well, the power rigs the network, right?
Yeah.
If we can unrig the network, that would be a step forward, but we still don't know what the network's going to decide in all of these cases. Let's end it on that, because it is now 1:24 of a meeting.
It's all my fault. I apologize.
That's fine. I don't mind. As long as people don't mind listening to it, I'm not. But we've got one more discussion, which is this Friday at noon. I'll be continuing to produce videos. I can already see how some of these will be relevant just based on the discussion that we've had. So I'll finish off the decisions we make video and then do the set for this week, probably sometime next week, leading towards Christmas, by which I hope to have them all done. But once I do the last one, I'll schedule and put it out in the newsletter. One last wrap-up, drink it if you got it, kind of discussion to wrap up what we thought of the whole course. But I hope you found it interesting so far.
Yeah, it's great. And by the way, I have to teach Friday, so I'll miss. I don't want you to think, well, you didn't like this.
Yeah.
This has been fabulous. Thank you for welcoming me and keeping it open. And I'm fascinated by your thoughts. Thank you.
Right. So
I'm already looking forward to the next iteration of the course because I think it'll be.
It's interesting.
By a factor of I don't know what. 10.
It's the course has become more popular as it's gone along, which is unheard of for MOOCs.
That's a communication problem. Yeah. So I think if we focus on the communication before the next iteration, I think the next is just going to, because it's going to have all this material already prepared.
All those videos will already exist. I won't be focused on making videos. I'll be able to look more at some of the backup materials and that. And then actually having people be able to talk about these issues, that would be good.
Yeah, because we're... there's been a lag that has developed. And perfectly understandable. It's not a criticism at all. But, to have all the material from day one, or all this material all from day one to build upon is, I'm really looking forward.
Yeah. All right, then. I'm going to wrap it up. So, bye to you two. Bye, Sharita. Bye, Jim. I know you wanted to be here. By people in a future iteration of this course, by podcast listeners, by future generations in a world that was shaped and influenced by this small discussion. So long.